so much, Professor Tim. I'm really, really happy. I'm very happy to be here. I've had a very lovely day, and I'm honored to be a speaker in your series, the Comparison Project. I think religion today is a real reality. It's not just for theologians and professors. It's everywhere. We see it in our politics, our economics, our social spheres. And to understand one another is really, really significant, and especially traditions which play a very important role in the United States, and yet very, very little is known about it. I truly admire you for doing this project, and I feel very happy to be a part of it. And I had a great afternoon. I spent the afternoon, early afternoon, with the Sikh community, later on at Drake University with a wonderful class who had been reading my book, The Birth of the Khalsa, and had extremely interesting insights, comments, questions, and then here we are. Thank you all for being here. I can't tell you how meaningful it is for me to be a part of this. The talk today, Sikhism and Suffering, Understanding and Healing After the Milwaukee Massacre. As Wade and Page rampaged through the sacred space of the Sikhs in a Milwaukee suburb with his gun, what did he see? His ears so attuned to musical rhythms, what did they hear? Sikh worship centers on reciting, singing, and hearing scriptural melodies praising the divine, the common denominator across religions. As on a typical Sunday, men, women, and children dressed in their finery were gathering to share their sorrow or joy, find comfort, solicit answers, or just be together at the Gurdwara. That's a sacred space for the Sikhs. Guru, teacher, enlightener, Dwara, a door. So to that door of enlightenment, in this very beautiful space, they got together. With their heads covered in reverence, they would be seated on the floor, rich and poor, all equal in the presence of their sovereign, their sacred book called the Guru Granth Sahib. Draped in silks and brocades, this holy book is the core of Sikh religious and moral values, the focus of all their ceremonies and celebrations. Its reading would conclude with the singing of the hymn of bliss. The hymn is called Anand, so that's how all Sikh ceremonies end. And the partaking of warm, sweet sacrament called the Kra Prashad. It's served to the gathering, everybody partakes of it. Soon the congregation would be eating langar, a meal cooked and shared with one another, irrespective of caste, class, race, religion, or gender. Typical Sunday afternoon at the sacred space. But in an instant, all this came to an end. Shots were heard, which the unsuspecting devotees thought was a child's prank. It was, in fact, a fellow human being, a neighbor, shooting bullets at the congregation. Blinded by racism against the mud-colored and numbed by hate for music, this avowed white supremacist could neither see the richness in diversity nor hear the universal melodies. Throughout the 5.5 centuries of their history, the Sikhs, about 25 million worldwide, have experienced grave tragedies. They have been victims of hate crimes and mistaken identity on U.S. soil since way back in the late 19th century when they first arrived on the West Coast to work on the railroad, lumber industries, and farms. In 1907, there were racist riots against these early immigrants in Washington, California, and Alaska. Under anti-Asian laws, they could not own land or marry white people. Many of the Sikh bachelors married Mexican women because of their similar complexions and cultural habits, and thus created a bi-ethnic community erroneously termed Mexican Hindus, also Mexidas, whose descendants today are some of the most successful producers of walnuts, peaches, and plums. Those who wore the turbans as a symbol of their religion were called ragheads. Actually, as recent as a year ago, in connection with the now governor, Nikki Haley, whose parents are immigrants, Sikh immigrants, the senator of South Carolina remarked, "We've got a raghead in the White House. we don't need another raghead in the governor's mansion. That was very recent. When the immigration rules were relaxed under President Kennedy, a wave of sick physicians and engineers came to the USA. Soon, there was the Iran hostage crisis, and many turban-wearing Sikhs were mistaken as followers of Khomeini and came under racial attacks. Again, after 9/11, they were mistaken as followers of Osama bin Laden. In its immediate aftermath, a Sikh owner of a gas station in Phoenix, Mr. Balbinder Sodhi, was shot to death. Though very few Muslims in America don the turban, most Sikhs wear it as an essential item of their faith. There are at least 500,000 Sikhs in the U.S. There are hundreds of gurdwaras on the continent, and they're visible in all spheres of life, including the U.S. Army. We have a family here whose son-in-law is one of the first doctors to be serving in the U.S. Army as a Sikh. He was asked to cut his beard, but he refused, and he won his case, and he's there, a proud citizen of the United States of America. Yet, so little is known about them that they frequently end up as victims of mistaken identity. However, the love inspired by their sacred lyrics helped Sikhs convert any loss into triumph. Already we witness, after the Milwaukee tragedy, an awakening and a renewed commitment amongst the Sikhs. Men and women are initiating numerous projects in the areas of advocacy, education, and media relations. I have young Sikhs call me to get guidance in publishing articles on Sikhism. They're sacrificing lucrative jobs for raising awareness about their heritage. The process of healing for the Sikhs has been to empower themselves and their community. During adversities, any kind, death, theft, any disease, Sikh homes, places of worship, and hearts resound with the Sikh scriptural verse, Tera Pana Mitha Lage, Mitha is sweet. May your divine will taste sweet to us. So that's the prayer. Rather than pick up a gun and ammunition, they sit peacefully in the presence of their holy book to absorb its language of love. Thus they regain strength and wisdom to experience the beauty and wonder in the Creator's variegated multiverse. So, what is the notion of suffering in Sikhism? We've suffered through a lot. How does Sikhism, what is its basic notion? This is the question that Tim had proposed, and I've been thinking about it, and I really kind of base it on Buddha's fourfold framework. I think Buddha was just a genius in thinking about suffering, and his framework comes in very handy, the four noble truths. And the first noble truth is all life is suffering, dukkha dukkha. Very interestingly, in Sikh scripture, Guru Nanak, the founder, says the same thing. Nanak dukhiya sab sansar dukhiya. Nanak dukhiya says Nanak, the whole world suffers. And suffering is just not momentary. So suffering is not just physical, emotional. It's just being human. There's all of us suffer. There's an anxiety. And I think it was Heidegger who said, you know, we're neither stone nor fairies out there, nor gods, nor the divine. We are human. And to be human, there's an angst to us. There is suffering. We all suffer. And of course, some more than others. But suffering is universal. So there's psychological, there is spiritual, there is physical, economic, all kinds of suffering. And Guru Nanak, the Sikh scripture, the Sikh word, Sikh faith, acknowledges it. There is suffering. And there are many verses, as I was doing my research, that I found. Another one, Dukhi Parya Jagat Sabaya. Dukhi Parya, Dukhi. Dukhi Parya means full. The whole world is full of suffering. That's again a Sikh scriptural verse. But very interestingly, there's also a paradox that's introduced in Sikh scripture. Dukh Daru. So here things are twisted around. What happens is that dukkha becomes a medicine. Dukkha, suffering becomes a medicine, and comfort is in fact suffering. So there's everything is shifted around, turned around. And the way it's explained is, because when your everything is going fine and dandy, you're not becoming reflective. You don't think about things. You go on with your everyday life. That real suffering, I think it was also Paul Tillich, there's some kind of a depth to suffering. And that happens when we are hit with some tragedies, physical, spiritual, existential, whatever it be. And so Guru Nanak is kind of thinking about this subject, and suffering is considered a medicine, that's kind of a healer. That's really kind of important. So there is suffering. That's the first basic rule. And suffering can be good in the sixth worldview. Going to Buddha's second noble truth, there is a cause to suffering. And Buddha says it's desire. In Sikhism, the cause is selfishness, selfish ego. The word is homai, H-A-U-M-A-I. Homai is this little me, I. The self-centered, where the individual is all circumscribed into herself, into himself. You do not see beyond. You do not feel connected with the rest of the world. And it's considered to be the most essential problem. That's the core of our problems. And all the other vices that we have, you know, it can be desire, it can be greed, it can be, you know, calm, truth, anger. All those are emerging from this basic notion of selfhood, me. So it's kind of that ego that just sees itself, the selfishness that we kind of, how we can translate it as. In Sikh scripture, it's regarded as a wall, literally a wall, which kind of erects a barrier between yourself, the divine, and with fellow others. So you're kind of circumscribed to your own self. So that narrowness, that's what is the root of suffering in Sikhism. The cause of suffering is narrow self, egotistical, selfish self. Point number two. Three, there is an end to suffering. So this is not just, you know, okay, all life is suffering. Yes, there's a cause to it. But very clearly, there is an end to suffering. And that end is experiencing the divine, experiencing infinity. Because the divine is really not kind of a theological image of a god or a person as such. It is all space, it is all time, it is beyond gender, beyond causality, and it kind of leads you to that experience of pure infinity. So there's an end, and there are lots of verses that describe it. What is it? Dukh daraz kles bansai jis basai man mahe. Whenever you have that experience, whenever you have that feeling of infinity, that's when dukh darad may be physical pain, and Kalesha, which is kind of that psychological anger and all that, all those kind of negativities, they disappear when you experience that divine, when you experience that infinity. So it gives you very clearly that there is that realm, there is that state of being where you experience the end of suffering. So it is a possibility. And then the fourth, parallel to Buddha's fourth noble truth, how do you attain it? What is the method to it? And instead of Buddha's noble eightfold path, here it is simply reciting the scriptural verses. It's simply remembering the divine one. It's imagining that infinite one. So there's no other, there's no nothing that you can do. There's no yoga involved. You don't have to retire. You don't have to leave your households. In Sikhism, you marry. You're a part of everyday life. It's in our everyday lifestyles, in our everyday patterns of life, that we remember the infinite one, and that's how everything, how suffering ends. I just want to read you a beautiful kind of, it's a very poetic, the scripture. So there's a lot of alliteration of the D's. तू दयाल दया कर देखो दुख दर्द शरीरों जाए तू दयाल दयाल इज द कंपैशनेट वन यू ओ द डिवाइन वन व्हेन यू लुक एट अस ऑल आवर सफरिंग डिसअपीयर्स फ्रॉम आवर बॉडीज सो यू नो इट्स काइंड ऑफ मेकिंग दैट पॉइंट दैट देयर इज एन एंड टू सफरिंग एंड हियर अगेन the name is regarded as the medicine the divine name so as soon as you take that pill we go to a doctor we take a pill here you start reciting the divine name you start reciting the verses and it's interesting that you recite with others so you're not sitting just on your own you're not kind of aloof and you're not isolated but fellowship is very significant and so you unite with others you sit you recite verses and that is what soothes you that's what comforts you That's what happens when people, you know, I've gone to, after a funeral, people just go and sit in the presence of the holy book. There are no words exchanged. So people just hear the word. So without saying anything, you're hearing it, the melodies seep into you, and that is your way of attaining solace, comfort, end of suffering. And there are the whole, actually, six scriptures, 1430 portfolio pages, and all of it describes the state of attaining the end of suffering. दुख रोग संताप पूरे सुन्नी सच्ची बानी दुख सफरिंग दुख रोग डिजीज संताप संताप द ताप मीन्स टेम्परेचर एंड सो फॉर्थ सो संताप ऑल काइंड्स ऑफ रिमोर्सेस सो एनी काइंड ऑफ ऑल द टाइम यू हैव रिग्रेट व्हाई डिड आई से दैट दैट्स माय बिग पेन ओ व्हाई डिड आई से समथिंग टू सो एंड सो ओ यू नो एंड यू काइंड ऑफ ऑल द टाइम वी हैव दीज एंग्जायटीज एंड अकॉर्डिंग टू सिक्स स्क्रिप्चर दुख रोग सुन्नी सच्ची वंस वी स्टार्ट हियरिंग द मेलोडीज वंस वी स्टार्ट Hearing these beautiful verses, those dissolve. Another one of my favorite verses. I'm sorry, but I want to share the original verse with you. Diva mera ek naam, dukh mein chupaya tel. Diva mera ek naam. So here, the lamp, you know, in the olden times you had lamps where you had the oil. So the lamp is your suffering. The oil is the suffering. The wick, the light, is remembering the divine. So when we remember the divine, all that oil is sucked up by the wick and it disappears. So that, I think, is a very central image. How do we get rid of our suffering? By thinking about the divine one, by reciting the divine name. And so all our suffering, if we can just imagine that lamp, the oil being our suffering, we are there. And once we start remembering the divine, and that divine is infinite, all that suffering is absorbed in that light, and we are left with joy, ecstasy. So those are some of these images that are very central to Sikh scripture about suffering. In the Milwaukee instance, it was not just Sikh. We all suffered. We all suffered. It was a tragedy, not just a Sikh tragedy, it is an American tragedy. People across America felt the pain. There was profound mourning across the country. The media gave a lot of attention and has shown great sensitivity. Remember, rather than the excitement of Olympics or that of rover landing on Mars, that was happening that weekend. CNN instead was continuously covering the tragic happenings in Oak Creek. Newspapers, radio, and TV across the nation tried to circulate information about the Sikh faith. Sikhs and non-Sikhs have together offered their deepest condolences to the families of the victims and prayed for the speedy recovery of the wounded. They have joined together in candlelight vigils all around the country. Personally, I'm touched by the empathy extended by my students, friends, and colleagues. White and black, Jewish, Christian, Hindu, and Muslim. It was heartening for me to get a call from a group of aspiring high school journalists. This was for a summer program at Princeton, journalism program, and they wanted to do a story on Sikhism. And I thought, wow, you know, these are our future bridge builders. So it was really good that they were doing something on Sikhism. I got sympathy cards and messages, including one from Tim. I'd never met Tim, and yet there was such a profound empathetic message I got from him saying that he had been to the Gurdwaras and what a beautiful place it is and what happened. A former student of mine, a white student who lives in the South, Dr. Ashley Level, who's gotten a PhD in psychology, lives in Alabama. What did she say to me? I felt like I had been punched in the gut. Student, a white, non-Sikh woman felt the punch in her gut. We are in pain and bewilderment. What do we do? Where do we go? How do we fully heal ourselves? And who are the we? The we constitutes all of us who have been born in America and or have chosen to make it our home. It includes every brown, black, yellow, and white. Had there been a rampage in a mosque or a synagogue or an African-American church, it would have been equally devastating. The challenge ahead is to familiarize ourselves with difference and diversity. Over the last 50 years, cities and suburbs like Oak Creek are becoming increasingly multicultural, multi-ethnic, and multi-religious. We are a part of a rich American mosaic, but sadly, we hardly know anything about our neighbors. Long ago, and this is something I mentioned in class this afternoon, I'm very fond of the American poet Walt Whitman. He was in New York, and he wrote that he's been very influential in my own life. And he wrote the poem called Passage to India in 1861. And it's a really beautiful poem, which I didn't discover till I came to America. And according to him, this is Walt Whitman writing from New York. Sorry, the poem came out in 1871. Low soul, seest thou not God's purpose from the first? The earth to be spanned, connected by network, the races, neighbors to marry and be given in marriage, the oceans to be crossed, the distant brought near, the lands to be welded together. I love that image, welding, you know, so the lands have to be welded together. Century and a half later, with our world getting much smaller today, we ironically are becoming much and more afraid of losing ourselves, of losing our identity, our addiction to technology, email, Skype, Facebook, shopping via internet, even for guns, makes us more insular and deflects us from establishing links even with our families and friends. No wonder a community event, especially of foreigners, can be threatening for a loner. Some of our political leaders are making matters worse by intensifying the looming atmosphere of anger, hatred, and fear. They take pride in the rhetoric of hate and anger against other religions, against immigrants, against other cultures, all of which degrades the general public and provides a rationale for the recent senseless massacres, whether they take place in a parking lot, a movie theater, or a gurdwara. In this dangerously divided and polarized society, it is essential that we actually get to know our neighbors with different colored eyes or complexions or accents or texture of hair or those simply dressed differently. This has to begin at an early stage, and all of us have to take the responsibility that our education and popular culture reflect our multicultural reality. From nursery school to university, our education can no longer remain Euro-Anglo-centered. Primary school needs to introduce people who look and speak different so they feel comfortable from day one and grow up secure rather than afraid of strangers. We need new bedtime stories for our children that will show kids in different complexions and different hairstyles, including boys with long hair, so that a little Sikh boy with his braided hair will not be teased in his school. Sikh boys and girls do not cut their hair. So in this part of the world, for a little Sikh boy to wear his braids, his mother does his braids, he goes to school, he's teased awfully because we don't know anything else. We have our gender codes, we have our gender roles. So we need to change those things from a very early stage of life. Middle school and high school curriculum should incorporate the history, religion, cultures of the various civilizations. Since I'm located in the field of Sikh studies, I find that at the university level, Sikhism is woefully neglected. The community is working hard to rectify the situation by endowing Sikh chairs. However, there has to be an initiative from the institutions themselves so that Sikhism and other forgotten traditions can become a part of mainstream curriculum. And that's why I really feel very indebted, grateful to Tim for organizing this, for bringing these marginalized religions to the center. It's deeply essential. urgent, and to have that vision, I'm profoundly grateful to you. Likewise, we have to ensure that the diverse designs and protagonists of our patchwork heritage. Remember, President Obama said that in his historical inaugural speech, we have a patchwork heritage, and we should make the most of it. So Sikhs and others, communities, need to be visible in museums, bookstores, industry, be it toys or fashion, and on the screen. Globalism appears to be going in one direction, with Anglo culture dominating the globe. Hollywood could easily move beyond its fetishism with whiteness. And I was giving this example this afternoon about The English Patient. I don't know how many of you saw that film. It was a really lovely film made by Minghella, which has a Sikh protagonist. But the book is so much more powerful, where this Kirpal Singh, it shows his identity, it shows his sacred space, and all of that is deleted on the Hollywood screen. So it's a pity, you know, even if it had been flashed for a few minutes, people would get curious about what is this religion, who does this belong to. So we need more on the screen, more Hollywood, something, you know, where our popular culture is bringing other traditions. And the young students that I met today were doing so many different things, journalism and so forth, and I hope you will continue, keep this on your radar as you become famous and do your stories later on. And I would also suggest reading of scripture. I think scripture has every scripture, the New Testament, the Hebrew Bible, the Tao Te Ching, the Holy Quran, the Vedas, the Guru Granth, every tradition is, you know, it just kind of, the scriptures encapsulate it. But somehow we're being scared about scripture. Oh, and I don't know, maybe we just find it's too daunting. Is it because it's the other, or is there some kind of a thing we might lose ourselves if we read it? But we always kind of stay away from it. And that's why bookstores carry very few original texts, primary scriptures, sacred texts from religions that you find in Barnes & Noble and other places. And I think that needs to be changed. We really need to become more conversant with one another's worldviews. And what better way than Sikh scripture? So today, since it's in the context of the Milwaukee tragedy, I think I'd like to focus on the Sikh scripture and mention that reading it would be particularly relevant. The entire text, this is 1430 pages. For the Sikhs, this is it. This is the center of their worship. They go to the Gurdwara, they cover their heads, take off their shoes, and they sit on the floor in the presence of the book. It's covered with brocades. This is their sovereign. So if anybody gets married, they walk around the book four times. So the sacred book, the holy book, is everything. And instead of just having it in Gurdwaras, we should have translations. I know translations is not the same as the original, but still we need to access books. We need to become familiar. It's not we're disrespecting anything. We're just, you know, we're getting to know the other. We're getting to know them and becoming richer individuals ourselves. So it's really important to read text. And the entire text is scripted in the language of infinite love. Bakya pao. Bakya pao is love. It's the language of love. So it serves as an antidote to the hate-core music of Wade's white racist band, the Blue-Eyed Devils. Remember, he loved music. Mr. Wade, who went in and killed all these people, who went with his gun in the Sikh temple. His music, he was very much into music. That was hateful music. So this would be an antidote to that. The Sikh scripture, the music of love, the poetry of love. Actually, simply reaching out for the text releases some of the discomfort and anxiety that keeps one locked in, and thus sets the healing process in motion. So the healing, when we think about healing, what's going on in that process? I think it's getting in touch with something deeper and vaster, and Sikh poetry does just that. The founder of the Sikh tradition, Guru Nanak, celebrated the divine as a singular infinite reality. You know, what we would call God, what would be equivalent to the Sikh tradition, Ik Onkar. And it's literally a numeral, one. being is. And this one encapsulates everything, not just all space and time, but also language from the Hebraic world, language from the Indic world, from the Abrahamic traditions. So the one is Allah from the Judeo-Christian Islamic world, and it is Ram from the Indic tradition, because it's all one. How can I say this is monotheistic, this is polytheistic, this is monistic? Everything is that one. It's a very plural tradition, and once you, anybody can tap into it. So represented by the universal numeral one, anybody can access it. It does not reproduce the conventional monotheistic model, rather a distinct theological singularity that transcends all exclusions and negations. Hindu, Buddhist, Tantric, Islamic views that were current in medieval India come together in its wide-ranging literary spectrum. Binary oppositions between the Indic and Abrahamic worldviews are transcended. The Buddhist Nirvana is not omitted either. Itself Nirvana, it itself relishes pleasures. So all kinds of religious worldviews are a part of this one. It's literally numeral one. It's written like that, a one. So one being is, so everybody has access to it. Its inbuilt poetic exercise shifts attention from the individual self to something far larger. The opening poem, you know what the Sikhs recite every morning? It's a Japji. Everybody recites it. It's the first hymn in the scripture itself, in the holy book. And it reminds us of our human responsibilities in conjunction with the lunar and solar cycles. Our daily calendars with the limited standards of measurement acquire a much larger vista as we become temporally conscious of the billions and billions of years behind us and the billions and billions of years yet to come. Sach khand vase nirankar, that's a realm of truth. What's there? Tithe khand mandal varbandh tinka ant na ant. Here are continents, not just this room. Here are continents, constellations and universes, they're counting, never ending, never. So this is the world, this is the infinity, this is the realm of the divine. This is what we are supposed to imagine. When we start imagining those things, just think how psychologically, emotionally, we kind of stretch that individual, that home or whatever, that ego dissolves in this process. The evening hymn too. Evening, if you go to any Sikh temple, that's what they recite in the evening. It's called the Aarti. And Aarti traditionally was the evening, you know, where you have a platter. And on the platter you put lamps and so forth, and you encircle a deity. In Sikhism, there is no deity, there's no incarnation of any. The divine does not incarnate. The divine is all space and time. So, what do you do? How do you praise the divine? The skies become the dish, the plate, the platter, whatever you want to call it. And on it are sun and the moon and the stars. And what is the incense? This breeze. And what is the offering we make? Instead of little flowers from our garden, a whole of verdure, all of greenery, all the plantation. So in a way, everybody is involved in this praise. Everybody is involved in this worship. And the original is really quite beautiful. Gagan mein thal rav chandikat bane tarika mandal janak moti. You know, and literally, the sky is the platter, the sun and moon lamps, it's studded with pearls, the starry galaxies. This truly is your worship. So in a way, it invites everybody, Jewish, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, you know, we are together. We are praising that one we all partake of. So there's no divisions here. There's no boundaries. The magic of infinity has tremendous physiological impact. It releases anger, jealousy, hatred, and other such poisonous stuff. The mystery and thrill of reading scriptural verses makes us oblivious to the isms around us, be it racism, classism, sexism, or religious fundamentalism. Overall, then, reading the Guru Granth Sahib is a healing mechanism. Its lyrics, though universal, provide us with an outlook on particular social, economic, political, and religious problems that may arise at any historical moment. They reach us with an aesthetic energy crucial in shaping our worldviews, attitudes, and behavior. The verses reach into the visceral hub where dictatorial rules and regulations never quite make it. Unlike the hatred and divisions promoted by Mr. Wade's band, they produce positive energy within the individual, which ultimately makes its way to an acceptance and love for all others around. In contrast to Wade's racist ideology that divides humans into separate and exclusive biological entities, Sikh scriptural lyrics promote the feel for the singular, infinite creator, resulting in acts of love and compassion towards all siblings in the world. Plato, the harsh critic of poetry, quite well knew its force. He banned the poets from his republic. Why? Because poetry feeds and waters the passions instead of drying them up. Today, we desperately need lyrics of love to water out our parched empathy and to flush out the toxic sounds of hatred. We all need to stand together and speak the language of love against bigotry and racial attacks. Human language does not simply mirror reality, it has the power to transform reality. In the language of love, we can create arabesques of understanding that will usher us into a dynamic new future. As the tenth Sikh Guru said, "Jin prem kiyo, tin hi prabh payo." Those who love, find the infinite divine. Thank you very much.
If I'm understanding right, the mourning and the grieving will be displaced or dissipated by reciting your scriptures. But I was just wondering if you have a concept of forgiveness.
Very much so. I think it's a part of it. So you don't hold on to what, you know, you don't retaliate, you don't take revenge. So you forgive and you move on. And that's what it is. But it's coming together with the community and thinking, and instead of holding on to what somebody did, you forgive them. Actually, that's what people were saying. Even at the Gurdwara, I heard that they were saying, oh, the poor fellow, they were feeling bad. He doesn't know any better. So you forgive. You kind of look at it from their context. Where are they coming from? So you don't, you know, so the Sikhism is really kind of realizing maybe he's a loner, he doesn't know, and they were ready to, you know, kind of forgive. Yes, very much. So forgiveness is a part of the tradition. Thank you. what a lovely question. I definitely think so. Because what is it? You know, the world is not divided into the sacred and the secular. So you are a person, you are a householder, you're very much in this world, and that's where you're remembering the divine. So it is, I think, from the beginning to the end, Sikhism promotes that middle way. So you eat, not too much, to, you know, that you become totally unable to do, and yet you want to keep yourself fit. So it's very much, that's very interesting. I didn't think about it. It's very much so. It is the middle way, and it is in this life. It's really, rather than rejecting the light, rather than having monks and so forth, where Buddhism, that's where it would differ. But here, everybody is a part of life. And there's a very beautiful verse which says, Hasandya, Kilandya, Khavandya, Penandya, Vichye, Hove, Mukti. Moksha or liberation is attained in this world while laughing, dressing up, Hasandya, Kilandya, eating and playing. So it's quite intriguing. So it's very much the middle way, I would say. But in Buddhism, you still, the monks are higher up and they have renounced the world. So I see similarities, but I also see differences with the Buddhist tradition. How about Miri Piri? The Miri and Piri, you know, to have, like, the sixth guru, he took on this persona where things are both of the world, Miri, royalty, and Piri, spirituality. So there is that concept, you know, Miri, Piri coming together. Okay. So it's togetherness, you know, So it's in this world. It's very much, it's here. And what I would say, which really differs from Lord Buddha, is this world is good. There is suffering, sure. But suffering can be good too, as we said. So, you know, it's what's the obliviousness to the divine when we live that very self-centered life. That's what suffering is. Maybe I'm an optimist. I really see the young folks. It's these young ones who are so becoming so committed. And that's where I find Guru Nanak's verse very relevant. Dukh daru sukh rog paya. You know, so in this moment of crisis, they are really doing an amazing amount. I see youngsters in New York, Washington, D.C., who are really giving up lucrative positions, economists and so forth, wanting to enter the secret so that they can, they're more, even more committed. Before, every time such a such a tragedy happens, in 1984 too, in 84 when there was a crisis in India, there were many Sikhs who were not, you know, who were just had sort of forgotten the principles and so forth. And after that, there was really a great resurgence, and so many of them left their jobs and went into the study of Sikhism. And I'm feeling each time that happens, more and more Sikhs get committed. And they want people to know about their tradition. It's the young ones. Why did your young son have this question now? How insightful of him. And I think and there is an awareness in the general community as well to bring Sikhism. We just can't afford to have these kind of tragedies take place. So I think within the Sikh tradition itself, there's kind of an awakening, a commitment, a renewal, and outsiders too. I mean, there were so many youngsters who were taking this course on Sikhism, who were reading this book, and they had not heard about Sikhism before. So I think things are slowly changing. And this time, unlike 9/11, I have to admit, 9/11, the press, the media had a very different attitude. This time, they're showing a lot of understanding, thoughtfulness, and somehow, I feel in 20 years, people will know more about Sikhs and Sikhism on this continent.
Hopefully that works. Okay. I just had a question. Because Sikhism focuses extensively on now, on this particular life, is there any sort of moral theology or moral pattern of behavior that you can use to then distinguish between right and wrong on more complex issues? So, for instance, it'd be safe to say that killing is bad, and it would be safe to say that feeding the poor is good. But on issues of like the modern day, for instance, we see conflict with religion and homosexuality or abortion. How does a Sikhist go about approaching finding the moral or the way to be selfless in those issues?
The more I listen to you, and I wasn't familiar with Sikhism before this evening, but the more that I listen to you, the more what you describe sounds to me as to be humanistic, to be very much, you know, this is the way that the world is, and that the way it is to be human, and so the way we should treat each other is based in that. But I also hear you saying, you know, that your religion holds on to belief in God and belief in some kind of a supernatural force that I'm not fully understanding, I think, you know, from this evening. But so my question is, you know, wherein is the evidence for that supernatural power?